The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
Thank you so much. It is wonderful to be back. But these are truly terrible times, but also deeply inspirational times for how people respond to that terror. Today, of course, is Independence Day weekend. And I thought that I would begin with a famous quote, and very appropriate here, as I was met at the door by Anthony Arnov, talking about Howard Zinn and people's history of the United States and voices of people's history and how wonderful it was when the great historian would be there for those amazing readings that Anthony coordinated. I remember being there one day with James Earl Jones reading the remarkable words of Frederick Douglass back in, I think it was 1852 in Rochester, New York, that speech he gave, what to the American slave is your 4th of July? I thought I'd just read a few words. I wish Howard was here to introduce James Earl Jones reading this, but he was reading the words of Frederick Douglass saying, "Fellow citizens, pardon me, allow me to ask, why am I called upon to speak here today? What have I or those I represent to do with your national independence? Are the great principles of political freedom and of natural justice embodied in that Declaration of Independence extended to us? And am I therefore called upon to bring our humble offering to the national altar and to confess the benefits and express devout gratitude for the blessings resulting from your independence to us? I'm not included within the pale of this glorious anniversary. Your high independence only reveals the immeasurable distance between us. The blessings in which you this day rejoice are not enjoyed in common. The rich inheritance of justice, liberty, prosperity, and independence bequeathed by your fathers is shared by you, not by me. This 4th of July is yours, not mine. You may rejoice, I must mourn. To drag a man in fetters into the ground, into the grand illuminated temple of liberty and call upon him to join you in joyous anthems were inhuman mockery and sacrilegious irony. Do you mean, citizens, to mock me by asking me to speak today? What to the American slave is your 4th of July? I answer, a day that reveals to him more than all other days of the year the gross injustice and cruelty to which he is a constant victim. To him, your celebration is a sham, your boasted liberty an unholy license, your national greatness swelling vanity. Your sounds of rejoicing are empty and heartless, your denunciation of tyrants, brass-fronted impudence, your shouts of liberty and equality, hollow mockery, your prayers and hymns, your sermons and thanksgivings with all your religious parade and solemnity are to him mere bombast, fraud, deception, impiety, and hypocrisy, a thin veil to cover up crimes that would disgrace a nation of savages. There is not a nation of the earth guilty of practices more shocking and bloody than are the people of these United States at this very hour." Frederick Douglass concluded, "At a time like this, scorching irony, not convincing argument is needed. Oh, had I the ability and could reach the nation's ear, I would today pour forth a stream, a fiery stream of biting ridicule, blasting reproach, withering sarcasm, and stern rebuke. For it is not light that is needed, but fire. It is not the gentle shower, but thunder. We need the storm, the whirlwind, the earthquake. The feeling of the nation must be quickened. The conscience of the nation must be roused. The propriety of the nation must be startled. The hypocrisy of the nation must be exposed. And the crimes against God and man must be proclaimed and denounced. That speech, in the midst of slavery, given by Frederick Douglass in 1852, in Rochester, New York, given to the Women's Anti-Slavery Society. Those remarkable words, if only it were true what President Trump said, he's doing an amazing job. Talking about Frederick Douglass. As if we were alive. But you know, I think Frederick Douglass may well be alive. His spirit in so many remarkable people, a number who are here at this conference, or people like the Reverend William Barber, who is just leading the Poor People's Campaign. We were just in Washington covering the mass mobilization, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people arrested over the last 6 weeks. And as we were there on the last day, the final rally and march to the Capitol, when they were stopped by police and Jesse Jackson, who was with Dr. King the day he was assassinated in 1968, and the Reverend James Forbes, the Reverend Emeritus of Riverside Church, stood there as the police told them they could not move forward. When they said, "Oh, the tourists can walk, we cannot," Reverend Jackson said, "We're getting a border police action here." And when I asked Reverend Forbes about the separated children, Frederick Douglass's speech could have been about separated children as well. Reverend Forbes said, "Yes, we know about separated children because of the history of slavery in this country. This is not new, but it cannot go on," he said. And I think about Michael Bennett. I hope you all get his book here today, published by Haymarket Books, Things That Make White People Uncomfortable. He was just in Democracy Now's studios. As he talked about his action, I dare say Frederick Douglass would be kneeling next to Michael Bennett. You know, that Time magazine cover of Dr. King kneeling next to Colin Kaepernick and Michael Bennett. And I think about the NFL owners, and maybe majority billionaires, decided to hand down the ruling that the football players, 70% of them African American, would not be allowed to kneel. If they did, they would be fined. They could opt to stay in the locker room, in the back of the bus, if you will. But don't come out and show us how you feel. And I think about Michael Bennett's power as he moves from the Seattle Seahawks now to the Philly Eagles. And think about the company he will keep there. Not only Michael Bennett, but you have, for example, Malcolm Jenkins. Malcolm Jenkins, who responded to President Trump's disinvitation, right, the Phillies win the Super Bowl, always invited, the Super Bowl winners invited to the White House, and Trump said no. So Malcolm Jenkins had no words for the President of the United States that he cared to utter. Instead, standing in front of reporters, he simply held up signs like, "You aren't listening." And more than 60% of people in prison are people of color. Another sign, "Any given night, 500,000 sit in jail. Convicted? No. Too poor? Yes. End cash bail." Another sign, "Colin Kaepernick gave $1 million to charity."
And in 2018, 439 people shot and killed by police thus far. That was weeks ago. I think the Washington Post most recently said, I think the number is now 519 killed by police so far. And I think of that edict handed down by the NFL owners. It wasn't hours before Antoine Rose, 17 years old, African-American teenager about to graduate, was gunned down in Pittsburgh. Gunned down by an officer who'd been sworn in a few hours before. One of the witnesses said it was as if he was taking target practice on this young man's back. Yes, I think Michael Bennett, Colin Kaepernick, have shown us what it means to stand up for a more just society by kneeling. And speaking of going up, I think of a young woman who, while maybe you were here at the conference on Independence Day on July 4th, I think of Therese Patricio Okomo. Oh, she's a naturalized U.S. citizen. She's from the Democratic Republic of Congo. You might have heard about her because she started climbing the Statue of Liberty on July 4th. With Rise and Resist, they were protesting, but she sort of broke away from the group and tried to make her way up. Yes, this security risk. They cleared 3,000 people away from Liberty Island that day. And what did she say? She just broke her silence as she got out of detention and said, well, she said she was just following the words of the former First Lady, Michelle Obama, who said, when they go low, we go high. I went as high as I could. The horror on the border. Let's talk a little about that. But before that, oh, a little history lesson. A little while ago, we had Cy Hirsch in the studio. He's just come out with his new book called Reporter, a Memoir. My colleague Dennis Moynihan and I wrote a column that week, just a few weeks ago. We began it, and babies? Answer, and babies. These four words, broadcast by CBS News in 1969, had a profound impact on the American public, the Nixon presidency, and the course of the Vietnam War. Questions about babies have arisen again at the White House, this time about thousands of immigrant children, some only months old, ripped from their parents and jailed in cages on the orders of President Trump. That question asked half a century ago, and babies? Was posed by veteran investigative journalist Mike Wallace while interviewing a young Vietnam veteran named Paul Meadlow. And babies, Meadlow answered. He was an Army private who, along with scores of other U.S. soldiers, conducted a raid on March 16, 1968, attacking a Vietnamese village called My Lai. What followed came to be known as the My Lai Massacre. U.S. soldiers slaughtered over 500 civilians over the course of a day. Meadlow told Wallace they was begging and saying, no, no, the mothers was hugging their children. We kept right on firing. They was waving their arms and begging, he told him. Meadlow was brought to CBS by Cy Hirsch, who was investigating the massacre. He tracked down Meadlow, got his story, and convinced him to do the CBS interview. It was so painful to hear Cy Hirsch talking about tracking down Meadlow in Indiana
a broken young man, when he met his mother at the door. His mother said to Cy Hirsch, "I sent them a good boy. They sent me back a murderer."
So Cy tracked down Meadlow, got his story, convinced him to do the interview. What Hirsch uncovered about the My Lai massacre haunts him to this day. He said about his new book, Reporter, a Memoir, "Instead of meeting the enemy, there were just families, women and children and old men, so they began to murder them. They put them in ditches, they raped, they killed, they threw babies up. This was hard for me to even in the first year, and caught them on bayonets. Some of the stuff I kept out of the initial story, it was just so awful." He recalled of Meadlow's CBS appearance, Mike Wallace, who's tough as nails, asked him five times in that interview, "And babies?" Again, Meadlow kept saying, "And babies." Hirsch later published the story through the small anti-war Dispatch News Service, after the major US media outlets turned down the story. It earned him a Pulitzer Prize in 1970. Hirsch sees parallels with how the press is finally covering the immigrant family separation crisis. He said it could be a turning point. "Yes, today we see photos of crying toddlers next to handcuffed parents, accompanied by an audio recording released by the news outlet ProPublica, in which children are heard crying, 'Mama, Papi,' while a guard mocked them, saying in Spanish, 'Well, we have an orchestra here. What's missing is a conductor.' Sadly, I think that conductor is in the White House. Elected officials, the media, have flocked to the U.S. border, demanding access to detention centers. Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen was questioned at White House briefing why her department had only released photos of jailed boys in the cages over the age of 10, not photos of girls or toddlers. They said, 'Where are the girls? Where are the young toddlers?' She was repeatedly asked. Her confusion stoked more furor. And now they tell us that the number they gave us, this is the HHS Secretary Azar, of 2,000 children, might be more like 3,000. He said, "Don't say 3,000 or over 3,000, nearly 3,000, he told reporters on a phone call the other day. They don't even know. They knew they wanted to rip these children out of the arms of their parents, and they don't even know how many they took or where they sent them to." You might have seen on the news today, and we broadcast it on Democracy Now! Today, a Guatemalan mother reuniting with her daughter in Boston. It was so beautiful to see. Her little girl, as she hugged her and wept, hadn't seen her for 2 months. Don't think that was the U.S. government giving her up. That was because of a court case. And this is what's happening. Guatemalan mothers are, because of court cases, not because the government is willing to set these children free. One mother making her way to New York because of friends who raised money. She was afraid to fly, afraid she'd be taken again. They drove her for 4 days. And now parents are not even able to hold their children at night because they are given out to foster families. And if they're not the sponsor of their child, they're not allowed in the house with them at night. How is it possible that this is America today? Democracy Now! Went down to the border last week. For those diehard Democracy Now! Fans, you might have listened last Thursday and Friday. On Thursday, we broadcast from the square outside the Brownsville Federal Courthouse, where so many immigrants had been taken, tried en masse. You know, when we flew in to Texas, when you have luggage, you get a little receipt. These parents don't even get a receipt for their children. And now they're saying they're doing DNA testing of the children. How exactly will that be used? How exactly will that be used?
We know that in various shelters, various detention facilities, I don't even like to use the word shelter because shelter means you're sheltering, comforting someone. These kids in these detention centers, in these jails, in cages, we interviewed one whistleblower who had just quit Southwest Key facility. He was Brazilian, spoke Portuguese, and he was in the facility. These are the experts they get, right? He was the capoeira teacher. And then suddenly he's there all the time because they need people. They have so many thousands of people being brought in. And he sees this family of children, 16-year-old brother, 10-year-old brother, and an 8-year-old sister. And they're huddled, and they're weeping, and they're wailing. He's saying, what's going on? They say, oh, they speak Portuguese. And he went over, and he said, what's the matter? Of course, he knew the bigger issue of being separated. They said, our parents are killed. And he said, what do you mean? And someone had used the word lost to them. Your parents are lost, and they took it to mean killed. And he said, no, they're lost. They're not killed. And the 16-year-old is holding his 8-year-old sister, hugging her. And the supervisor came over to Antar and said, tell them now to let go of each other. They are not to hug in this facility. And he said, you tell them, I quit. Which brings me to Juanita Valdez Cox, who runs the organization Lupe in South Texas. We sat on the Brownsville, in the Brownsville Park, where they had one of the biggest protests ever in Brownsville, like well over 1,000 people. I don't know how many of you watched the great Issa Rae's Insecure, but Jay Ellis was one of those who spoke, an African-American actor in that HBO series, and talked about the history of separating children back to slavery. But Juanita Valdez Cox sat with us under the hot, baking sun right before the rally, right after we broadcast the show, and you know, she's trying to help reunite these families. And she talked about an 8 and 10-year-old brother separated from their father, and they're deported by themselves into the notoriously violent Reynosa. That's over the border from McAllen, like Twin Cities, and Matamoros is right over the border from Brownsville. The parents are desperate. Where are our children? And they're found walking in Reynosa. An 8 and a 10-year-old. And then she talked about the 9-month-old and the 1-year-old in one of these facilities. She said, oh yeah, maybe they change their diapers and maybe they give them food, but they won't hold them. They won't hug them. That's against the rules, they said, because the U.S. government is concerned about child abuse. Who's engaged in child abuse now? Which brings me to the beautiful letter of Dana Sinopoli. She's a psychologist in Philadelphia. Everyone in their own fields, in their own worlds, with their own families, are trying to figure out how they can help. This is the beauty of this country. I don't think it would be dissimilar to any country in the world. So she penned this letter and just posted online. Thousands and thousands and thousands of psychologists. By 2 weeks ago, I mean, within days, it was 12,000 mental health professionals and hundreds of mental health organizations and universities signed on. In that letter, she wrote, to try and argue that this policy of ripping children from their parents at the border is somehow different from the systematic traumatization of children during the times of slavery, forced assimilation, and the Holocaust is to disregard history. To somehow convince ourselves that this systematic traumatization of children has no bearing on the lives of these children and no impact on the legacy of our country is to be living in an alternate universe. And to not care about the impact these policies have on these children is to succumb to the worst potential of humanity. July 10th. Next Tuesday, every child under 5 who's been kidnapped by the U.S. government has to be returned to their parents, to their families. That was the ruling of a San Diego federal judge 2 weeks ago. He said within 2 weeks, these children under five must be returned, and within 4 weeks, every child that has been taken must be returned. Dana Sabra's ethnicity might not surprise you. His mother's country of origin is Japan. Yes, the Japanese and Japanese Americans know well the history of internment in this country. 110,000 Japanese and Japanese Americans ripped from their homes and put into camps all over this country. You know, I'll be in places in Washington State, I'll be traveling to Santa Fe, New Mexico, and you see these markers of camps. No, not what Laura Ingraham called, God, you're just putting them in summer camps. Of these detention camps, or what Andrea Pritzker, who we just had on, said absolutely fitting in with the definition of concentration camps. That's what we're talking about here. As she said, don't forget Guantanamo started as an immigrant detention camp. You remember years back when Haitians were put on Guantanamo, held by the US government. They wanted them there so they'd be just outside the reaches of US law. Now we have a resident of the White House who doesn't care about law. So he doesn't have to worry about putting them beyond the reaches of US law. They've just thrown it out altogether. He started by calling Mexicans rapists when he came down the escalator in Trump Tower and announced he was running for president. Then he was calling Mexicans rapists. Now he calls them animals. He talks about these immigrants infesting this country. I never thought I'd be quoting William Crystal, the neoconservative, but when he heard that term infested, he said, it must sound better in the original German. After we covered the mass protest, as people were protesting around the country, it was last Thursday, and over 600 women got arrested in Washington, D.C., like Linda Sarsour and Susan Sarandon and so many others. We were in Brownsville. And the next morning after the broadcast, we headed to Mexico. We headed over the bridges. These are the ports of entry that Jeff Sessions, that President Trump says, why don't these immigrants do it legally? Come over the legal ports of entry. And so we went to see the old bridge and the new bridge that goes into Matamoros. We went from the Texas side into Matamoros and then came back on the US side, heading to the US. Midway through the bridge over the Rio Grande is a tent. And that's where the border guards are, right at the border between Mexico and the United States. They didn't always set up there. In fact, this is completely brand new. They used to be on the US side, but now they don't want anyone stepping foot over the border. And they're right outside the tent. They need a tent because it is so hot and the baking sun. It was a Guatemalan mother, 21 years old, and her 2-year-old baby. Was getting a rash and the heat. They had not just been there that day, but they had come from the new bridge where they'd been for 3 days. They are repeatedly being told, and we went to the new bridge as well and heard the same story from a Guatemalan father and his little girl. They're being told it's full. But our country is full? This is against the law. It's against national law, it's against international law. immigrants who are fleeing persecution have a right to take refuge in our country and then go through the proper legal process. And the proper process is to go through these legal ports of entry and just give yourself up to the authorities, and then you go for your asylum hearings. And the U.S. is simply saying no, which forces them to do it illegally, to pay these coyotes, to take them at enormous cost of thousands and thousands of dollars over the river. A number of people have drowned into the hot, baking deserts. That's what they're being forced to do by the U.S. government. And now you have a situation where you, at this point, have thousands of families separated, and then you have President Trump defying the judges and saying, well, if we can't keep them separated, we will set them up in permanent detention facilities. Brian Paris, who's an environmental activist with Sierra Club in Houston, pointed out that one of these military bases they were talking about setting up a tent city on is a Superfund site. But you know a lot about this. And what is really important to understand right now, in so many different areas, is how important the resistance is. It isn't just Scott Pruitt's corruption that led to his ouster this week as EPA administrator. It's the movements, it's the environmentalists, it's the grassroots journalists, and the mainstream journalists as well, who have found a backbone now that Trump has hit mainstream journalists so hard. They sometimes sound like Democracy Now! Saying media is essential to the functioning of a democratic society. And they have been rising to new heights. It's really important to say. They have been doing a superb job, for example, on this issue. But watch out, it's not in all areas. When it comes to issues like war and climate change, it's just a reflexive position of the media. They just can't do it. Like with Syria last year, when the US bombed that airfield with, 58 cruise missiles. The media was critical, because Trump was already slamming them hard. Remember, during his rallies, he's pointing out journalists, he's calling us the enemy of the people. He's done it right through, to right now. And journalists stood up, except when it comes to war. I remember coming home that night of the bombing of Syria, turning on my TV, it was MSNBC, and it was Brian Williams who used the word beauty or beautiful three times in 30 minutes describing the bombs flying over Syria, quoting Leonard Cohen, the beauty of the armaments. And also, right around that time, within weeks of Trump becoming president, he dropped the largest non-nuclear bomb in the world on Afghanistan. It was developed under George W. Bush. It's called the MOAB. The Pentagon dubs it the mother of all bombs, massive ordnance air blast, something like that, an air blast radius of like a mile. Drops it on Afghanistan. And from that to Syria, the beauty of the armament, says MSNBC. I'm not talking Fox. I'm talking about MSNBC and CNN. And Fareed Zakaria, I think he said, on one of those bombings, Trump became president that night. They circle the wagons around the White House when it comes to war. And then on the issue of climate change, there is no more important place to talk about climate change than every 10 minutes than when they bring us weather reports. That's when people tune in, they're figuring out what to wear. Well, you can also figure out what to do about it. If you know that the fires in Colorado and the dust storm conditions of the Midwest, and now the heat wave throughout more than half of the country, the freezing cold winters like we've never seen in the Northeast, the drenching rains and hurricanes in the South, no one will think these are connected if someone doesn't tell them about these connections. They're so disparate
I mean, these meteorologists shouldn't have the seal of approval of, well, I don't know if they go to meteorology school, but they shouldn't be able to call themselves meteorologists if they don't stop, if they don't start flashing the words. They've got two words, extreme weather, they flash it all the time, and it is. They also flash climate change. They flash extreme weather and severe weather, but what about those other two words, climate change? Flash them. What about global warming and global disruption? Flash those words, climate chaos, and people will understand the links and the threat to humanity, what we are engaged in, and understand the link to President Trump pulling the US out of the Paris Climate Accord, why Democracy Now! Goes every year, wherever these climate summits are, we're there, from Copenhagen to Cancun, from Durban to Doha, from Lima to Poland to Paris. We're going back to Poland this year. Now, this year, the U.S. is totally pulled out, but it's even more interesting then, because we're seeing something we haven't seen before. Governors, senators, mayors, grassroots activists are all coming together. They're setting up a sub-national coalition and uniting much more easily with countries around the world and saying, we're still in. It will make this country stronger, and it's so important to document and project the voices of a world that's much more advanced than us on climate change, grassroots activists. You know, when you're at the target end, you really do understand people in sub-Saharan Africa making their way to these climate summits to say, you're cooking our continent. Or the 15-year-old boy from the Maldives who comes to one of these climate summits and say, you're drowning my country, as he looked into our camera. It is our responsibility. We populate the most powerful country on earth. We ultimately can decide how that power is exerted, and we have to understand the power of everyone's voice and how they can educate us, and how important it is, especially now in this country, that there isn't a they in us when it comes to the immigrants and the naturalized citizens and the natural born citizens. We are one. And that is also why it's so encouraging around the issue of separation of children. Democrats, Republicans, Greens, Independents, old people, young people, everyone is understanding. You know, when I spend time with Jennifer Harbury in Brownsville, she's this amazing human rights lawyer and activist who has so much to teach us about how the U.S. exports violence, and then we experience the blowback of that. But she's the one who got the audio tape of the children crying, mama, papi, and the little girl just wailing and repeating over and over again her aunt's number. How old was she? 6 years old, but she knew that she was so smart. She knew she needed to talk, be with her aunt. And that tape that was heard around the globe that forced Trump to sign that executive order reversing the policy for the moment. Now the question is if they can undo the damage. I was speaking to a colleague, the great journalist Alan Nairn, and he was saying, you know, this isn't that hard. How many children are we talking about? Well, when we were talking, we thought it was 2,000. Now they say 3,000. Of course, I suspect much more, but let's say 3,000 for a moment. 3,000 kids, 3,000, 6,000 parents, whatever. What is that, 10,000? What about bringing them all? You don't have to find a football stadium. A high school auditorium, maybe. A huge gym. This is not that many people. Put them all together. You can have lots of social workers there and people who can guarantee, and people are going to run to each other. And you can start there. If there is a political will, and you're not doing this purposely, you're not purposely making a generation of stolen children. As I was telling the story, Democracy Now!, we have classes come almost every day to watch the show. And a class of high school students from Australia came. And one of them was an indigenous high school student who said, I know about the stolen children. My grandma was a stolen child in Australia. They didn't want her to speak her language or practice her customs, so they ripped her from her family. They put her in one of these schools. We know this in Canada. We certainly know it in the United States. And they tore her language and culture from her. And she said, we have felt the repercussions of this generation after generation, still trying to recoup what we have lost. This horror unites us with people around the world. But I want to go back to Jennifer Harbor, who has so much to teach us from her own personal experience. Yes, she released the video. And when I was speaking to a wonderful leading immigrant rights attorney named Efren Olivares from Texas Civil Rights Project, who's trying desperately to unite these children with their parents, I met him at a public forum last week in McAllen, Texas. He said, you know why that tape is so powerful? He said, you know why it's captured the imagination of the world? You know, you usually think, well, oh shoot, it's an audio tape, too bad they didn't have video. And he said, it was the fact that it was an audio tape, he said, that you couldn't see their brown children. It ripped everyone's hearts wide open. I mean, it's both a sad statement and a very profound statement. But he said everyone could identify with those wailing children. So that audio tape was gotten by Jennifer Harbury. A whistleblower inside handed it to her. Jennifer Harbury has lived in Brownsville for like 40 years. And she started going to Guatemala decades ago, because she has been working on political asylum cases for that long. And she was going to Guatemala because she had to prove in these political asylum hearings that people were fleeing from persecution in Guatemala. So she was taking testimony in Guatemala. There she met her husband. His name is Efraín Bámaca Velázquez, Everardo, Comandante Everardo. He was a guerrilla in Guatemala. In the 1980s, he was captured by the Guatemalan military. She never believed he was immediately killed, as they said. And she started to demand, where is he? And she held these long hunger fasts in front of the presidential palace in Guatemala City, out at remote army bases. And then in the United States, in Washington, D.C., demanding to know what had happened to her husband, Everardo. She knew the U.S. was involved with training the Guatemalan military, and she wanted to know, where was he? This went on for a few years. It turned out he probably lived for 3 years. And then a Congress member in New Jersey named Congressmember Torricelli gave her some critical information that the government wasn't giving her. That he had been alive, that he was tortured by a man named Colonel Alperez, who was trained in the United States, that the U.S. was involved in his torture and ultimate killing. She would not stop until she was able to blow up this cover-up that the U.S. government was involved with. You know what happened in Guatemala, as happened in El Salvador. The hundreds of thousands of civilians who were killed overwhelmingly by the Guatemalan military, the Salvadoran military, and the paramilitary death squads in both countries. It wasn't a war. It was a slaughter. And sadly, in both cases, the U.S. was on the wrong side, was supporting these murderous right-wing regimes. You know, in El Salvador, about Archbishop Romero. When was he killed? March 24th, 1980. I always think March 24th because it was my mother's birthday. Right? He's giving the speech to the country, to the Salvadoran soldiers, saying, I urge you, I beseech you, I beg you, put down your arms. And as everyone listened on their radios to the great Archbishop, he was gunned down. those gunshots heard around El Salvador. And same in Guatemala. And as Jennifer describes it today, we're talking, what, 30 years later. She says those same people trained by the U.S., these murderous death squads and the officers and the militaries, are today the cartels that are so dangerous. You can make direct links, she says, to this training and the blowback and what people are fleeing from today. So yes, no matter what, even if this weren't the case, we should care because people are fleeing violence, even if it wasn't originally caused by us. But that's how so many of our parents and grandparents and great-grandparents came to this country if we're not Native American, or sadly came unwillingly if you were African coming here as enslaved people. But even if we weren't connected to the violence, we should care, just open our arms, truly embodying what the Statue of Liberty is supposed to be saying to the world. But we are connected to this, and this is our responsibility, and I don't even make such a distinction between people who are fleeing political persecution and people who are coming here for economic survival, because it's all part and parcel of the same thing. When you devastate countries, when you pull their resources to us and you keep the people back, as Jennifer Harbury was talking to us, we learned that Vice President Pence was in Guatemala saying, stop the exodus. When we have fair and just trade policies, when we stop arming murderous regimes around the world, that's when we can start talking about what is fair for people coming to this country. Now, after we spoke to Jennifer Harbury and went across the bridges, we went over to Southwest Key. That's the nonprofit that runs the old Walmart in Brownsville. I mean, think about this. Walmart's right, who have all these low-cost goods from immigrant labor around the world, low-paying jobs. Now that place is closed, and it's become a jail for migrant children, 1,400, 1,500 of them. We can't trust the government numbers. They just stop telling us. Once Judge Sabra in San Diego said they must all be reunited in the next 2 weeks. The government stopped giving out numbers until they were forced to do so a few days ago and said maybe it's 3,000. So it increased 50%, right? They had said 2,000, now it's 3,000. Who knows what the number will be next week? But we went over to Southwest Key and we tried to get a statement from those that are imprisoning the children inside, and the security, the sheriff's deputies, the private security came at us and said they would arrest us if we stepped foot on, and the signs were all there, private property, keep out, private property. I mean, even the few windows that the old Walmart has are blacked out. These children kept in total captivity, only comforted by their Mylar blankets. No, they said, we'd be arrested if we stepped foot on the property. These children are the private property of our government right now, and their responsibility. And so we raced off to Brownsville Airport to get our flight. Now, there's two plane airlines that go into the Brownsville Airport. One is American, and one is United. Now, you may have heard that United Airlines said they would not transport separated children. They made that decision. Maybe it has something to do with the CEO, whose name is Munoz. But United Airlines won't take separated children. Then I heard a rumor that some group was taken because they were told it was a soccer team.
These are groups of separated children being fanned out to 17 different states. But the statement of United, based on our serious concerns about this policy and how it's in deep conflict with our company's values, we have contacted federal officials to inform them that they should not transport immigrant children on United aircraft who have been separated from their parents. Munoz said in a statement last week, our company's shared purpose is to connect people and unite the world. This policy and its impact on thousands of children is in deep conflict with that mission, and we want no part of it. It's extremely laudable. I think they learned something after, when was it, 2015, they dragged that Asian American doctor down the aisle because they wanted his seat, breaking his teeth and his ribs, but they've learned. And then killed that dog. But they learned. They learned.
Put it in the overhead compartment.
And they said no. American is still transporting the children. This is all happening in plain view. So I went over to the American personnel there and I asked them about the policy. They said, we don't talk politics here. We don't talk all young Latinos and Latinas. But they have jobs. So they want to keep their jobs. And then we went over, oddly enough, in Brownsville Airport, the Amelia Earhart Cafe. It's called Amelia's Cafe. Very unusual for a person who had great problems with flying, but she was captured. But we sat down and a young man named Santiago came over to serve us, to give us some tacos. And I said to him, what do you think? Not expecting he would say anything because people get very nervous. He said, heartbroken. I said, have you seen children here? He said, of course I see the children. And then I said, would you mind if we interviewed you? We had a camera on the table. And he said, yes. I have twin 13-year-old brother and sister. And he said, I want to talk. He said that it started months ago, and two men came in, they sat down, and there were all these children right outside the cafe sitting on chairs. And he said, and they ordered breakfast, and he said, do you want to give the children, because they were clearly minding the children. They said, no, they don't get the breakfast. He said, bring them something. No. And he said they were all wearing their little uniforms, you know, they're like sweatshirts and sweatpants, and they have little baggies. And so they would sit out there. And then he started to understand, because he kept on seeing this, children sitting right outside. They're being flown around the country. These are children from these jails being flown to other jails or who knows where. And he kept watching, and it's kept happening. As late as this week, when they said they had stopped doing this, he said, oh no, just on Monday they were here. And then we go through TSA, it's a tiny little airport, and as we're going past, the TSA officer says, we've got some UMs right over there. UMs are unaccompanied minors. It's affecting everyone, every walk of life. There's a beautiful book called Stones in the River by Ursula Hegge, and it's about a dwarf in World War II, not Jewish, but she's a dwarf growing up in a German town, and how the whole town transforms to be a Nazi town, and how they respond to her, a young woman who they had cherished and loved, and how they changed when they considered her the other, because it wasn't just Jews, it was so many others. And that's what I thought about in the airport. As some people speak and some people don't, some people are nervous, some people don't talk. And just as we go through TSA, they say, the kids are over there, the kids are over there. And we sit down and there's two boys, they're in black sweatshirts. They've got little baggies, they're with a minder. And as one went to the bathroom, our reporter, Laura Gattesina, got up. She speaks Spanish, and she talked quickly to him and said, where were you? He said, Southwest Key, last 3 months. Are you separated from your family? So I'm going to family in Florida. but there were lots of separated children who were being brought in, he said, very quickly. And he was very, very nervous, and then he sat down. And when we went over to speak to the minor, she got angry, the minder. And she said, you stay away, these are minors. And she worked for Southwest Key. So we all got on the plane and flew to Dallas, and then we were gonna fly through to Newark. So we hadn't slept in about 48 hours, everyone was totally exhausted. We went to gate, what, B-13, where the American flight was gonna take off, and everyone sprawled out on the chairs, and right there next to us on the next set of chairs are 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 more children. We recognize them, now they're getting a little smarter, the minders or who's ever doing this. They weren't wearing the same sweatshirts and pants. They were wearing different clothes. They were all wearing the same slip-on sneakers, brand new. 5 years old, 7 years old, 9 years old girls. The boys look 7, 8, 9 years old, all carrying little baggies, and we knew. So Laura went over to look at the Newark flight and said to the oldest girl, she looked maybe 9, maybe 10. She said, you going to Newark? And the little girl said, don't know where we're going. And immediately the two minders, an older gentleman who looked exactly like Santa Claus, white hair, white beard, said, what did you just say to her? And so she said, just asked if she was going to Newark. You don't talk to her, you know the situation, you don't talk. And she asked if he would talk. He said, you get away. It's the situation. It's the situation. This is all in plain sight everywhere. You know, watch. Keep your eyes open. If you see something, say something. It's everywhere. It's everywhere now. It's involving the whole society. And that's why the whole society has to respond. And people are. In every walk of life, no matter what their politics, this is going to the essence of humanity. I never say of who we are as Americans, because I think people are like this all over the world. And it is freeing us to be who we are. I mean, the level of resistance right now, I mean, just look at the last year from January 2017, the Women's March, you know, Trump has his inauguration, and just the next day, not comparing it to Obama, who he's obsessed with 9 years before, that his was 10 times larger than his, but just the next day, the women, 3 times larger, their march in the same exact place at the same exact time. And that was just in January. Hey, did you hear that J20 crew, those that got arrested in the last 2 hours, the breaking news that everyone had the charges dropped against them? But think about the amount of time that took. And think about the suppression, how they have felt for a year and a half. I mean, this is meant to suppress dissent, to criminalize people. I mean, they weren't just facing a month in jail. We're talking decades and decades and decades in jail. This was serious. And now they're just dropping all the charges. And that was the group that protested J20. Then there were the marches the next day, J21. And then Trump imposed the Muslim ban, and massively not organized, thousands of people went out. Everywhere I speak in the country, I say, did you hear about Newark? Did you hear about Dulles? And all the people that went out to the airports, to JFK. And they say, what about our airport? We were there. And Trump said, who's paying them? Because it's the only thing he understands. Judges went out, senators were manhandled. People just said no, even if the Supreme Court did just uphold this now. This isn't the end of it. It's just not the end. You know, you don't achieve democracy. You have to fight for it every single day. And you move from the Women's March to the anti-Muslim ban to the March for Science to the on Earth Day, which was one of like the coldest Washington Earth Days in history, to 7 days later,
April 29th was the People's Climate March, and that was one of the hottest days in recorded Washington, D.C., April 29th history. That was in the 7-day span. And the young girls who came out saying they want to be scientists now, how important that is, and you jump forward to today and you see Scott Pruitt resigns. Yes, involved in every... Yes, involved in every form of corruption there could be, so insanely crude and upfront and out there. I mean, demanding one of his top aides go to Trump Hotel to get an old Trump mattress for him. And then we did a little research for the headlines that day to let you know what he did, what that particular corruption was, and learned that Certimattress had ended their relationship with Trump, not willing to make Trump mattresses anymore because of his policies. You know, this doesn't start with the corporation, but it's because of consumer pressure, and consumers are citizens and non-citizens who just care, and corporations are responding, as we see with United, as we see with CERTA. And that, of course, was not the end of it. In the last week, you learned about these secret lists he's keeping of who he's actually meeting with, and he just fired one of his top aides because she refused to keep the list because she knew they're illegal. They're against the law. And then he builds this soundproof booth that wasn't even certified as soundproof but cost over $40,000 and didn't get approval, completely illegal. The question is, you know, will he be prosecuted? A number of these investigations will continue, but the greatest corruption of all, of course, is what he has started, what he did to the environment. The rollback of environmental legislation or the rollback of environmental regulations that have been built for decades, the protection. And don't ever say, when you have a conversation with someone and they talk about, well, I support deregulation. We need a more deregulated society that might even appeal to some of you anarchists, if there are those out here. It's not about deregulation. It's about clean air, clean water. It's about the air we breathe. It's about the food we eat and knowing that it is safe and it is healthy. And that's what he has jeopardized. That's the horror of Scott Pruitt. On Monday, Kristen Mink, holding her little baby, challenged him in a Washington, D.C. Restaurant. You might have seen the video. And she's a mom and a D.C. teacher. She was sitting with her husband and her kid. Her husband said, I think that's Scott Pruitt over there. So she just got up and told him, you know, just asked him the simple question, why don't you resign? She got her answer on Thursday. He did. So, we interviewed her today, of course, along with Mustafa Ali. He worked for the EPA for 24 years and quit almost immediately last year when he saw what was happening to the EPA now with the Hip Hop Caucus. And I asked Kristen Mink at the end of the program, who are you planning to have lunch with next week? Of course, she said she had a question for President Trump. She's looking for him. But you think about this grassroots activism, the real corruption is what he's doing to the environment, and it's very important that he's gone. But you think of who's replacing him. His choice, Andrew Wheeler, right? Top coal lobbyist. Someone compared Andrew Wheeler to Vice President Pence and Pruitt to Trump. Right, Pruitt and Trump, all the flagrant corruption that's all out there and the inconsistency and the just unpredictability. And then you've got the one who keeps on moving along, doesn't have any of that chaos around them. And you ask which is more dangerous. So Andrew Wheeler now, people will sigh, heave a sigh of relief. But it's so critical to understand what he represents and who he's worked for, for Murray Energy for so many years, the coal company, for Inhofe, the most severe, most climate change denying senator, famously in 2015 took that snowball onto the floor of the Senate and said, who's talking about global warming? We should be talking about global cooling, because he had a snowball in his hand. So the struggle continues, but it's movements and dogged journalism, it's environmentalists and impatient mamas and papas who said no to Pruitt, and that's why he's out. So I just want to end where I always do, especially when I'm in Chicago, and it's talking about Emmett Till and this remarkable moment we are in, because Emmett Till is from Chicago. But to talk about Emmett Till, I first want to talk about Rosa Parks, the great activist. That's not how the media referred to her. When Rosa Parks died a few years ago in Washington, D.C., her body was the first, she was the first African-American woman to lay in state in the Capitol Rotunda. And we were in New York, and CNN said Rosa Parks was a tired seamstress. She was no troublemaker. Rosa Parks, of course, was a first-class troublemaker. She knew exactly what she was doing. She sat down on the bus December 1st, 1955, and in so doing, stood up for us all to oppose segregation, to oppose the back of the bus, to stand up as a woman. She sat there, and she had done this before. That's what's so important to understand, and that's what gives us hope today. Yes, that moment changed history. She gets arrested. 4 days later, the Montgomery Improvement Association has its meeting to choose a leader, to lead the bus boycott, and they choose a young minister who just came into town, Dr. Martin Luther King. Rosa Parks helped to launch Dr. Martin Luther King as she was in court that day. What's interesting is that she had done this before. Not exactly to no effect, but it certainly wasn't this effect. And other young women had sat down on the bus before. And so when you see one young woman climbing the Statue of Liberty, and other women in Washington, hundreds of them getting arrested, and Reverend Barber every week getting arrested in Washington, you never know when the magic moment will come. But if you're involved in activism, in social change, you're building a foundation that will determine the future that will make history. Rosa Parks was a first-class activist. The media denigrates activists, but what can be more noble than dedicating your life to making the world a better place? And she was utterly brave, because if you go back a few months before, to the summer of 55, that was the summer of Emmett Till. This was a story she knew well, as she had also investigated the rapes of so many black women in the South by white men. She led that movement, Rosa Parks. But Emmett Till lived with his mom here in Chicago, 14-year-old African-American boy, and she wanted him out of the city for the summer, her mother, Mamie Till. And so she sent him to Money, Mississippi to be with his aunt and uncle and cousins, and he was asleep one night in their house, and he was dragged out by a white mob, and he was tortured, and he was ended up on the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. And when his body was dredged up and sent back to Chicago, his mother, Mamie Tills, did something incredibly brave. She said she wanted the casket open for the wake and the funeral. She wanted the world to see the ravages of racism, the brutality of bigotry, and thousands of people passed by his casket and saw his distended, mutilated head. And then Jet Magazine and other black publications took photos, and they were actually published. And they were seared into the history and consciousness of this country. Mamie Till had something very important to teach the media of today. Show the pictures, show the images. Could you imagine if for just 1 week we saw the images of war? We saw a baby dead on the ground in Yemen, one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes in the world that we are intimately connected to, Yemen. in these US-backed, US-armed, Saudi-led assault, slaughter on the Yemeni people. If we saw a woman in Yemen who had her legs blown off but was still alive, had been to a wedding party, but in a US drone strike, she was a victim. And we learned her name, and we found out who was in love, who was getting married. It's so important to know the names. If we learned about a baby in Afghanistan, and we learned her life story, and we learned who her parents were, and it was the top story of every newspaper, of every radio and television newscast. If we, every tweet, every email talked about a soldier dead and dying somewhere in the world. Americans are a compassionate people. They would say, no, war is not the answer to conflict in the 21st century. And finally, going back to World War II, to the Holocaust, since that's so much on the minds, I think, of so many people today, as these children are dispersed throughout this country and separated from their loving parents. I think about a young woman and man, a young brother and sister named Hans and Sophie Scholl, who weren't Jewish, they were German Christians, and they thought, what can we do in the face of the Nazi atrocity? And they, together with other students and workers and their professor, formed the White Rose Collective. And they thought, at least we can get information out so that the Germans will never be able to say, we didn't know. And so they made 6 pamphlets, and one of the pamphlets that said, we will not be silent, and they distributed these everywhere they could. They would hurl them from balconies, they would put them in the cover of night, in an alleyway, in a marketplace, in a schoolyard, and hope they would be taken. Well, they were captured. Hans and Sophie and their professor, they were detained, they were charged, they were tried, they were convicted, and they were beheaded. But that philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of the media today, the Hippocratic Oath of us all today. We will not be silent. Democracy Now!
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.